Morning. I think we are all ready. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals on 16th, 2020. My name is Louise Devery Bjorkman, and I am joined as on my panel this morning with judges by Judge Peter Reyes and by Judge James Flory. The first matter on our calendar for oral argument is Jessica Hagen versus Stephen Scott Management Incorporated. You will each have 15 minutes for your arguments. As you see, one of our WebEx boxes is going to contain the timer. So we all know what that means. Counsel for appellant, you will have, in addition to your 15-minute arguments, 5 minutes for rebuttal should you choose to use it. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honor. Can I just note that I don't see Judge Reyes or that he's actually in the call?
He's there.
Yes, he had good view.
Yes, I am here. I am on the call. I'm not sure why you can't see me. That might be a good thing, but at least as long as you can hear me.
The judge, you just appeared. I can see and hear everyone now.
Excellent. Thank you so much. I appreciate everyone's patience as we use this technology, but it's important to the court that we hear your arguments and that you're available to answer our questions. So thank you for your patience as we proceed. Again, Mr. Brown, you may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. My name's A.L. Brown, and I represent Jessica Hagen in this appeal. I want to address primarily the summary judgment standard at the outset. The summary judgment standard is key in this case, in part because the district court made multiple findings of fact and made them in favor of the non-moving party. That was a primary error just without reaching the substance of the district court's order. Just on the procedure, he did not give the findings of fact the deference to the non-moving party, which would be Ms. Hagen. For instance, on the issue of whether the property was a fair market value and therefore apply the administrative rule relating to rent credits, the district court found that it was, even though it acknowledged that the defendant hadn't presented any evidence on that. That was clearly something that was.
Mr. Brown, can I just stop you there? Was there evidence as to what the apartment, the general rental for the apartment would be before the credit was applied to it? It wasn't it like $1,400 a month or something like that?
Judge, there was, I believe the lease was in the record, and that would have indicated the monthly amount that was expected to be paid for the contractual amount that would be paid for the apartment. But I don't think that goes anywhere near answering the question as to whether that's a fair market value. I could drop a lease for $1 million for a shanty in the bottom of some neighborhood that no one wants to live in, and no one would call that a fair market value.
So what kind of evidence should Scott Management have proffered, if any? I mean, what do you think was required to prevail on summary judgment?
Evidence of a fair market value. And so they would have had to have said an apartment of this size, in this neighborhood, in this condition, would generally go for X in an open market where people can make transactions at arm's length transaction. This is what someone would ordinarily pay for it.
Mr. Brown, this is Judge Peter Reyes. I have a question along those lines. Is this an argument, a separate argument that you are making, or is it just an example that you're providing of where you're arguing that the district court judge provided the wrong or implemented the wrong summary judgment standard?
This is an example.
Okay.
Of the district court finding that another, and I can give the court another example, and then I'll move off of the examples because I think they're adequately set forth in the brief as to why the district court improperly applied the summary judgment standard. On the on-call issue, the district court made a finding that these were mere inconveniences to Ms. Hagen, the having to respond to a call within 20 minutes, having to return to the location at a given time, that those were mere inconveniences. I think it's the district court's language on that. Well, that's not for the district court to say. That is actually not a legal question. That is a factual question as to whether it's a mere inconvenience. And
Were the
Ms. Hagan.
facts, Mr. Brown, were the facts about that really contested? I mean, as I understand the record, your client submitted an affidavit describing, the limitations that the on-call requirement placed on her life. I'm so. So, at what point is it a fact issue versus if the facts are undisputed, does become a law, a legal issue for the court?
Well, Judge, in this particular instance, where the litigant is saying, this is an inconvenience for me. This is an imposition on my time. I can't go grocery shopping. I can't visit family freely. I can't do all of these things that affect me. This affects me in a way that is negative. I don't think it's for the district court to simply say, no, that's a mere inconvenience. And so I agree to some degree that the defendant did not put into the record anything that would suggest that Ms. Hagan's description of the imposition was incorrect. So we may agree on the universality of the facts that this is how it affects her, but the district court reaching the conclusion that a fair-minded jury could reach the exact opposite conclusion, that if you're in the middle of a shopping trip at Target, and you have to stop what you're doing because the pool at your local, at your employer's resident needs to be cleaned, or that there's some emergency, that isn't, that's more than a mere convenience, that you can't go to your family's holiday at Thanksgiving. And I should, if I could just interrupt my argument for a second, I can't see the timer. And so I don't
Okay, you
want
have
to.
9 minutes and 43 seconds remaining.
Thank you. Thank you. You can't attend Thanksgiving or Easter or any other holiday because it's outside of the 20-minute radius of your home. A fair-minded jury could say that's more than an inconvenience. That is a duty that you are working, and that the employer is getting the benefit of your time without pay. Those are examples that I offer the court as it relates to the summary judgment standard being completely misapplied and all of the facts and inferences being taken in favor of the non-moving party and not Ms. Hagan. One more, because I think this one is also important. The question of whether she actually had to live on the premises. Ms. Hagan says, no one told me I ever had to live on the premises in order to get in order to be employed here. And in fact, Ms. Hagan put forth an affidavit in which she says, I know of another employee who did not live on the premises. The district court reached the exact opposite conclusion and says, it's obvious that you had to live on the premises in order to be employed. And he did so by looking at a letter that did not say that employment was conditioned upon residency on one of the properties. I want to be very clear with the court. There's no question that in order to get the rent credit, you had to live on the premises, but that was not necessarily a requirement of being employed there. I think I interrupted a
Mr.
question.
Brown, I on that summary judgment standard, which I think I agree with you. I think that's vitally important here. But let's just take the last example. There seem to be some undisputed facts. For instance, the language in the agreement that they entered into, the offer letter itself, as well as her own affidavit, that seem to have facts that are undisputed. Why is it that the district court could not look at those undisputed facts to determine whether or not she actually was required to live on the premises?
I have no objection to the district court, Judge Reyes, looking at the undisputed facts. That's wholly proper. The problem is that the district court characterized the undisputed facts in a way that transformed them from being neutral facts that everyone agrees upon to a conclusion. For instance, the district court looked at the letter, the offer letter, and said, well, it's obvious from the letter that you had to live here. And Ms. Hagan is saying, no, it's not obvious from the letter that you had to live here. It's obvious from the letter, the offer letter, that you had to live there in order to get the rent credit. It's obvious from the letter that you couldn't get the rent credit without living there, but it's not obvious from the employment letter that you had to live there in order to work there. And to double down on that, Ms. Hagan offered a real live example. Here is another person who did the very job I did that was not required to live there. So it's not that the district court looked at the wrong facts. He took the inferences, and that's also important in the summary judgment. He took the inferences that belong to Ms. Hagan and gave them to the respondent. I want to go to the substance, if I may, Your Honors, to the substance of each claim. The the minimum wage plan. I want to start there. As I said in my brief, there are two ways to really kind of look at this case. You can look at this case as a violation of the wage laws. You can look at it as a violation of the payment of wages laws. But I think the most natural way is to look at them as a violation of both, because those two statutes work together in a statutory scheme to determine when and how Minnesotans are paid. The underlying theory of the respondent's case is this: they are entitled to an industry-specific waiver of the minimum wage law. So they are at the one employer or the one type of employer that is permitted to barter with its employers. Instead of paying them in wages, they want to pay them in rent credits.
Mr. Brown, I'd like to ask you a more basic, more fundamental question first, because you refer to both statutes, and there are those two statutes that are in play here, as well as some related rules that have been promulgated. I did not see this in your brief anywhere. Would you agree that none of those statutes or the rules are ambiguous at all?
I don't think there's ambiguities in the statutes or the rules.
So we can just apply the plain meaning of any of the rules or the statutes.
That is, I don't see any ambiguity, and I don't think I've argued that there's any ambiguity in the statutes or in the rules.
Okay, thank you.
The minimum wage law is plain. Every employer, and it says every, must pay a minimum wage. Now, that wage is based on whether you're a small employer or a large employer, but it must pay a minimum wage. And then it defines what a wage is. Amongst the things that are defined as a wage, you will not find rent credit.
I agree with, can I just ask, I agree with you. Nothing in statute 177.2.3 subdivision 4 identifies rent credit as a wage. And yet we have a separate section, 177.28 subdivision 3.2, that directs the agencies to consider and develop rules around allowances for things like housing credits. So how do we read those two statutes together, Mr. Brown? Because I agree with you that the former doesn't suggest rent credit would be a wage. The latter suggests it may be. How do we square those two statutes?
Judge, here's what I will offer you. I will confess that is difficult, and I struggled with why they would permit regulation on something that they are not authorizing. And so you will see in my brief footnotes relating to the regulation of the drug trade and so forth, even though clearly the sale of drugs is illegal. So why would you regulate how you could sell drugs? And I think the best answer I could offer the court is that they're trying to head against the federal system that permitted wages to rent credits to be considered. Tying into the court's question, the federal law at its inception in 1938 always permitted rent credits to be considered. Minnesota comes along decades later and does not include rent credits. And so the best I can offer is that against that background, that the legislation, the Minnesota legislature, being fully aware of what's permitted in the federal system, it then said, if the feds are going to allow it, we're going to at least regulate it. But they did not permit any wages to be considered by rent credits. They did not consider them to be an exchange.
Mr. Brown, on that same issue with that statute 177 allowing rules to be promulgated, one of the rules that I think is very relevant here is Rule 5200.0070. And that specifically does talk about wage rates for board and lodging to allow for that. That seems to indicate, despite the fact that that 177 does not specifically define wages as, or rent credits, I should say, as wages, that rule implementing it seems to indicate that rent credits are in fact allowed to be considered as wages. Can you address that rule, please?
Judge Reyes, I believe that rule is just, again, it is an effort. This is my best offer on this. It's an effort to deal with the federal system. Because again, when Minnesota created its laws, it did not, against the background that clearly permitted rent credits to be considered wages. It chose not to go that route. And so to the extent that that rule is understood to expand Minnesota's definition of a wage, we've said in our brief multiple times that that rule must fall. It cannot expand the definition of a wage. I know this may have struck some in the brief as, you know, kind of an extreme example, but there are multiple ways in which employers compensate their employees. We would not consider the healthcare benefit to be a wage. And the dollar value for that, if Allina decided to pay its employees in healthcare benefits, no one would say that that could stand, even though it is clearly a form of important compensation that makes a person decide whether to take a particular employment, but it's not a wage. Wage is a defined term by statute, and neither the regulations nor the federal system is permitted to overrule what the Minnesota legislature has said on that point. I don't know how much time I have. I'm flying blind, Your Honor.
And I'm sorry about that. You're just about up with your time. I'm going to ask the panel members if they have any questions, and you will have 5 minutes. I'm going to ask if we can figure out why Mr. Brown can't see the time. I know you're at a disadvantage on that. Any other questions from the panel members?
I do not.
Okay. Mr. Brown, you will have 15 minutes for, or not, you won't have 15 minutes. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. Brown, can you check and see if you are in the grid mode? You
should I see am. I can see your name. I can see everyone else's name.
And they're all at equal size screens?
They are. But now I've lost Judge Reyes. I'll figure it out. I'll be okay.
Okay.
All right. Turning now to the respondent's argument. You will have 15 minutes, and I will try to remember to give you a 5-minute warning to the extent you cannot see the time. You may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors, Mr. Brown. And I can see the timer, Judge Gorton, so there's no need for that. I'm Andrew Tanick. I represent the respondent, Stephen Scott Management, Inc., on this appeal. And I would like to spend most or possibly all of my 15 minutes addressing the minimum wage issue, and I will try not to repeat what's in our brief. To be clear, Stephen Scott Management is not asking the court to create a new exemption from Minnesota's minimum wage or wage payment laws. Stephen Scott Management is asking the court simply to affirm a summary judgment that simply applied a statute and rule that had been on the books, followed, and unchallenged for nearly 50 years. As you know, the Minnesota minimum wage law and other wage laws are set forth in the MFLSA, the Minnesota Fair Labor Standards Act, which is Chapter 177. In 1973, as part of the newly adopted MFLSA, the legislature ordered...
This is Judge Peter Reyes. We are familiar with the record and the history. Both of you provided, you know, extensive briefing and references, so we certainly appreciate that. I have a specific question, and what I'd like to do is actually just follow up on the last argument that Mr. Brown made.
Okay.
With respect to compensation versus wages, and I'll try to do my best to characterize what he argued, but in essence, I think he was arguing that wages are different than other forms of compensation, and gave the example of, for instance, health benefits. That's a compensation, but that's not a wage. That's something that credit be considered a wage.
Because the Minnesota Fair Labor Standards Act says it is. In Statute 177.28, the legislature directed the Department of Labor and Industry to adopt rules defining and governing allowances as part of the wage rate for board and lodging. There's no statute that authorizes health care benefits as part of the, quote, wage rate. And I would also add that the definition statute is expressly not exclusive. It says that these definitions apply unless the language or context clearly indicates that a different meaning is intended. And we have a statute here, the enabling statute, that clearly indicates that rent credits are also a valid way to paid wages. They're not limited to the four ways in the definition section because the MFLSA, the same act, tells us that we're not. It added a fifth way to pay wages in this enabling statute. And how do we know that the legislature meant for the Department of Labor and Industry to create these rules and not just to consider that or whether to have a rule or not? Well, I think counsel's argument makes my point for me. They're not in the definition section. It wouldn't be legal to pay somebody by rent credits unless the legislature had directed the DLI to do it and the DLI had issued a rule. And the legislature...
If I could just ask you, I mean, assuming that we accept your argument that the authorizing statute sweeps the notion of rent credit into the definition of wages under the Fair Labor Standards Act, I'm turning to Rule 5200.070, and my broader concern at this point is, has the respondent established the conditions that would be necessary even accepting your argument that rent credit can be a wage?
Okay.
Evidence, for example, of fair market value.
Right. Well, first of all, I would say that that is not a relevant issue but I will address the evidence. Because the rule says that if the employee, the caretaker, is not required to live on the premises, then the rule is silent. And it says if she is required to live there, then you have to look at the fair market value. Ms. Hagen has testified in her affidavit, I was not required to live there. You've heard that this morning. The rule does not address that. The rule simply restricts the use of rent credits to the fair market value if the person is required to live there, the caretaker. Now, you may ask, well, how does that make sense? And counsel would take the position that in its silence, the DLI was indicating that rent credits are simply not permitted when the employee has the choice of living there. But that really doesn't make sense. Under that reading, if an employee has a free choice whether to live on the premises and get rent credits or not, then you can't do it. But if the employee has no choice, the employer says you must live on the premises, then you can do it. Now, that doesn't make any sense. If the employee has a choice whether to live on the premises, then there's no need for her to be protected. She's making that choice. So the rule provides for no restrictions. It provides no protection. If, however, the employee is required to live on the premises, then she has no bargaining power. She is at a disadvantage. And the rule says, in that situation, we have restrictions. It is limited to the fair market value. So my first response to that question is that by Ms. Hagen's own contention that she was not required to live there, that throws out the fair market value issue. But if we assume that it does apply, because she also says that she was required to be paid by rent credits, and she could only get rent credits if she lived on the premises, we did present evidence of that. We presented the lease, which we've cited case law saying is prima facie evidence of fair market value. That's what the district court held. We have two cases in our brief that also say that. We also had affidavit testimony, which unfortunately was not in our brief, but in her affidavit at paragraph 5, the director of HR for Stephen Scott Management, Susan Hikas, testified that Ms. Hagen and the company periodically entered into new agreements to reflect changes in her allotted hours and the value of her rental credit. Her testimony doesn't say it was about the amount of the rental credit, but the value of the rental credit. So we do have testimony that the rent was based on the value of the rent, the fair market value. We have the lease, we have that testimony. That may not be insurmountable evidence, but what evidence to the contrary did Ms. Hagen present? Absolutely none. And we are all...
As the moving party, aren't you under an obligation to establish the record that permits summary judgment?
We did. We are. And we did. We have those two pieces of evidence. And it was incumbent on her, if she wanted to create a factual issue to preclude summary judgment, to present something to rebut that. We're all familiar with the case law that talks about mere averments not being sufficient to preclude summary judgment. In fact, Ms. Hagan, in her own brief at page 19, footnote 39, cites a case that says, to avoid summary judgment, the non-moving party, that would be her, must point to specific facts in the record to support its contentions. In the record at all. She doesn't even address this in her affidavit. The only evidence, but it's not evidence, that this was not fair market value is her counsel in his brief and argument saying there's a fact question. That's not evidence. If all it took to defeat a motion for summary judgment was counsel saying that's a fact question in their brief, there would be no such thing as summary judgment. So we have evidence. We would certainly have more evidence than that if the case went forward to trial, but we have enough to create a presumption, and Ms. Hagan has made absolutely no effort to rebut that presumption, and that's why there's no fact question on that issue, if the court even has to reach it, as I said before, since she has testified that she was not required to live on the premises, that limitation doesn't even apply. So,
I think Judge Reyes is trying to speak. I cannot hear you.
Sorry. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Sorry about that. I had myself on mute and have to remember to take that off. Mr. Tanik, I have a follow-up question on that. Under Rule 5200.0070, there are two aspects of that, two conditions under subpart one. And it sounds to me like you're arguing, and it seems like you argued more in your brief, that it's actually the first condition that applies, which help me understand if I'm correct or not on this, that applies if there's no requirement that she live on the premises. But the second half, where the employee must accept lodging as a condition of employment, that seems to be a requirement. So is your argument that she did not need to live on the premises, or is your argument that she did, that she was required to live on the premises based on the offer, based on the contract between the employment contract and other aspects of her affidavit?
Yes. Our argument is that it doesn't matter because we win either way, frankly. Issue of material fact if the resolution of the issue would not change the result. And frankly, Stephen Scott Management believes that its live-in caretakers are required to live on the premises, and therefore that is how we addressed it. Ms. Hagan maintains she was not required to live on the premises. This being a summary judgment, our position is, okay, then let's look at that. And if that's the case, there's no restriction because the rule only says if you're required to live on the premises, then you have to look at the fair market value. So we're basically saying we do believe she was required to live on the premises, but for purposes of summary judgment, if she wants to argue to the contrary, we'll accept that and we'll analyze both of those possibilities, and the result is the same either way.
Can I ask a question on a different note, and it's respect to the on-call time compensation?
Yeah.
Mr. Brown urges this court to conclude that questions about whether on-call requirements go beyond mere inconvenience are uniquely for a jury to decide, even if there's not large dispute as to what the inconveniences are. How do you respond to that argument?
Yes, well, it was interesting because in their brief, the appellant took us to task for not presenting any evidence that she wasn't inconvenienced. But of course, this being a summary judgment motion, that would have been inappropriate for us to introduce such evidence. So all the evidence of the inconvenience is the appellant's, Ms. Hagan's evidence. And it's our position that those are the undisputed facts. And based on those undisputed facts, was able and rightly applied the law and said, okay, I agree with you, Ms. Hagan. You couldn't go to a movie. You might have to leave early anyway. You couldn't go grocery shopping, whatever. Based on all those facts, as you have alleged them, that does not meet the standard set forth in the law that it has to be a sufficient inconvenience, whatever the language is, to prevent the person from pursuing activities of their own choice. And that's exactly what the court is supposed to do. It's supposed to consider undisputed facts and decide whether, based on those facts, as a matter of law, the moving party is entitled to summary judgment. And the judge did exactly that.
But Mr. Tanak, on that point, the law that is being applied, isn't that primarily persuasive law? Is there any controlling Minnesota case law on that point? I think you cite to Eighth Circuit and a number of other circuits, but I don't recall seeing any Minnesota state case law on that point.
I don't believe there is, Your Honor, in either direction. And that's why, you know, we cited one federal case that was decided under both the federal and state law, the Sletten case, but I don't believe either party cited any state court authority that was directly on point on the on-call issue. So we're left with a persuasive authority, as you said, and the language of the rule and the statute, which directly addresses the issue.
So why isn't this more properly a fact issue for a jury or a fact finder if there's no controlling Minnesota case law to see what the standard should be?
Well, you don't need controlling case law for a summary judgment. It's still a question of law because we are accepting all the facts as they are alleged by the plaintiff, the appellant, and then saying, okay, those are the facts. Does that meet the standard that is set in the statute and the rule as a matter of law, or does it not? And that's exactly what a district court is entitled to do. I just have a few seconds left. I just would like to say that, you know, the council has asked repeatedly in their briefs, why does Stephen Scott Management choose to do this if it's not to cheat people out of their minimum wage? And the main reason for that is recruitment. Employees love rent credits for several reasons. There are tax advantages. They end up being paid more than they would by the hour because they're paid the entire allotment, even if they don't reach their hours. Employees like Ms. Hagen prefer rent credits. That's why we do it. The main reason, there are also tax advantages, but it's not a plan to cheat people out of the minimum wage. And I see my time is up at this point.
All right.
Unless the judges have any questions, of course.
That's what I was going to ask. Judge Flory, Judge Reyes, any questions?
Nothing here. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Brown, then you will have the last word. 5 minutes for rebuttal, and you can see the clock now, right?
I can, Your Honor.
Excellent. You may proceed.
I'm going to start off where my friend left off, which is on the issue of why, if we're doing a dollar for dollar payment, why do it? And part of his answer was that there's tax advantages. Well, tax advantages for who? Tax advantages for Stephen Scott Management, which gets out of paying the presumably the employment tax, the workers' compensation tax, those types of advantages. Certainly, it would not be appropriate for this court to construe a wage statute in a way that would permit or approve of tax evasion. And if that's the core of the argument, if that's the rationale for why we're doing it, that's all the more reason why this court should be greatly concerned about the application. The persuasive authority that we talked about as it relates to the on-call time, counsel talked a great deal about, we just look at the facts and apply it to the standard. Well, the standard is what we forget to talk about. The standard is whether the employee is free to enjoy their time, whether they're doing something for the employee. So even if you take all of the facts, treat them as neutrally as possible, you can't get to summary judgment on that because it's clear that the employee is not free to enjoy their time. So you have to keep in mind what the actual standard that you are applying these facts to.
Right, Mr. Brown, to that point, a number of the cases that are cited have facts that seem more egregious in the sense of, like, for instance, rather than 20 minutes, there's like 5 minutes. I mean, you have to be within 5 minutes. I don't know how you could go anywhere in 5 minutes time. So at most, I think probably to your mailbox. So it seems that those cases definitely set a higher bar in terms of how the person would be inconvenienced.
I agree, Your Honor, and I think those cases are personally, I think they're wrong under the FLSA, but I also think they're particularly wrong under the Minnesota statute. And as the court is well aware, you don't just follow the FLSA blindly. You have to look at the language and the difference in the rules and how they are applied. Take, for instance, the Minnesota statute. The Minnesota rule says if you're tied to the premises, then clearly, if your employer says you have to remain on the premises, then clearly that's compensable. That's not in question under the Minnesota rule. Under the federal rule, the case of the firemen, that's not compensable. The outcomes would necessarily be different. And so I'd urge the court to look very clearly at the distinction between the Minnesota rule and the federal rule, and you'll see why the federal rule can create such harsh outcomes that are completely inconsistent with the Minnesota rule. You can't follow blindly the federal rule. I do take some.
But why is it that 20 minutes wouldn't be considered more than enough time for somebody to be off the premises? I mean, you can drive somewhere fairly close by 10 minutes and know that you can get back in 10 minutes. That seems a lot more flexible than just a 5-minute requirement, which does seem to be a requirement to essentially stay on the premises.
Because, Your Honor, in fact, the Minnesota rule says, are you free of any duty? It's compensable if you are performing any duty for your employer. And so I'm stuck with the Minnesota rule. I have zero interest in what the federal law is doing on it because I think it's completely incompatible with what Minnesota would require. And I would suggest to the court that if you are in the middle of a birthday party, as Ms. Hagan has said in her affidavit she has been, and have to leave for a family member, that's more than an inconvenience. If you feel as though you can't go to your family's holidays because they live outside of a 20-minute radius, that's more than an inconvenience, and a reasonable jury could conclude as much. I want to talk a little bit more about this presumption that counsel believes that his client is entitled to as it relates to the summary judgment. The law is plain. The plaintiff in the case at the trial court did not have to put up evidence against no evidence. The case law is clear. The non-moving party does not need to produce clear and convincing evidence to defeat a summary judgment motion. The moving party has the burden to show the absence of a factual issue. And so all of this talk about what Ms. Hagan put up, she only has that obligation once the defendant puts up something. And they're not entitled to any presumption. The Johnson v. Stitzman case, Your Honor, completely not binding on this court for all of the reasons we set forth in our brief. None of these issues were considered. This is truly, counsel mentioned that for years this has not been challenged. This is truly a case of first impression. And I'd ask the court to look very closely at Minnesota law and how it developed in the background against federal law and the choices that Minnesota made. It did not choose wages for rent. It does not permit the reduction of wages under the Payment of Wages Act. I appreciate the court's time.
Thank you, Judge Flory. Judge Reyes, any additional questions?
Yes, I do. I have one follow-up question. Mr. Brown, you state that this is a case of first impression. Could you be more specific as to what the issues you believe are issues of first impression briefly?
Very briefly, Your Honor. Candidly, neither of the parties, and I agree with the court, we did extensive briefing on all of these issues. Neither of the parties were able to produce a case as to whether the rent credits could be considered wages. That's an issue. There's no question, no cases directing us on the on-call time under Minnesota's minimum wage standards and those rules. There is only the Johnson v. Stitzman case as it relates to the payment of wages case. And you know the appellant's position on that's not binding because it didn't consider all of these issues that are now before the court for the first time. So really across the board, this is a case of first impression from the appellant's perspective.
Thank you, counsel.
Right. Thank you both for your helpful arguments, for your patience in dealing with our new way to present oral arguments in the Court of Appeals. We will take the case under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
Take care, Andy.
Thanks, AL. You too.
Hey, judges, I will move you back to the lobby.
Excellent.
Thank you.
I'm going to disconnect.
Thank you, Jim.
So, thanks. I'll look for your email and then I'll call in.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Thank you.